Podcasting worldwide via the internet from Lakeland, Florida, this is Whitfield Radio's True Believer program. And now, here is your host, the founder and president of Whitfield Theological Seminary and senior pastor of Christ Presbyterian Church in Lakeland, Florida, Dr. Kenneth G. Talbot.
Welcome to another edition of True Believer, and thank you for your prayers and support of this ministry. Today we are being joined by Dr. Kenneth Gentry, director of the NicenCouncil.com and the ApologeticsGroup.com. Dr. Gentry is a minister in the Reformed Presbyterian Church General Assembly and co-pastor of Living Hope Fellowship in Greer, South Carolina. We'll be joined by Dr. Gentry right after this break. Are you considering seminary education? Let Whitfield Theological Seminary provide your educational needs. Whitfield offers master and doctoral degree programs through distance education in ministry, theological studies, biblical counseling, and Christian education. You can complete your studies for the ministry or other church vocations in the privacy of your home in conjunction with your local church. For students who have never been to college, check out the Bachelor Divinity Degree program. Whitfield also offers lay study programs. Go to www.whitfield.edu for additional information. Remember, Whitfield offers classical Reformed theological education. Whitfield Theological Seminary, training a new generation of ministers around the world to disciple the nations in the theology of the Reformation. Today's show is entitled The Media as Theological Ministry. With us is Dr. Kenneth Gentry, and as we have noted, he is director of NicenCouncil.com and ApologeticsGroup.com. Dr. Gentry is president of KenGentry.com. He is an ordained minister in the Reformed Presbyterian Church General Assembly, co-pastor of Living Hope Fellowship. He lectures at conferences both nationally and internationally on ethics and eschatology. Dr. Gentry has served as professor of New Testament at Christ College, professor of theology lecturing on eschatology at Whitfield Theological Seminary, professor of theology and New Testament at Bonson Theological Seminary, and he is currently a research professor of New Testament and Eschatology at Whitfield Theological Seminary. Dr. Gentry's background in education is that he has a Bachelor of Arts degree from Tennessee Temple University. He attended Grace Theological Seminary for 2 years. He completed his Master of Divinity degree from Reformed Theological Seminary, the Master of Theology from Whitfield Theological Seminary, where he also completed his Doctor of Theology degree as well. Dr. Gentry has written the following books: Before Jerusalem Fell, He Shall Have Dominion, Navigating Through Revelation, Predestination, The Beast of Revelation, Perilous Times, and Divorce of Israel. Dr. Gentry has appeared in the following DVDs: Beast of Revelation Identified, Before Jerusalem Fell, Late Great Planet Church, Against Dispensationalism, Millennialism or Postmillennialism, Matthew 24 Debate, and Revelation Key and Summaries. Dr. Gentry, it's good to have you as our guest on True Believer here at Whitfield Radio.
It's good to be with you today.
Dr. Gentry, since graduating in 1989 with your doctorate from Whitfield Theological Seminary, how has your ministry evolved over the years?
Well, when I entered into the program at Whitfield Theological Seminary, I was already a pastor, which was one reason I chose Whitfield's program, is because it allowed me to continue my pastoral work as well as do academic studies. And so I was a pastor at the time, and I can continue to be a pastor today. But the opportunity of studying at Whitfield Seminary and getting the degree of PhD from Whitfield has opened up doors of opportunity for me. I've written a number of articles for various journals and Christian publications, and then eventually got into writing books. And so I've published a good number of books and have enjoyed extending my ministry through literature. And then, of course, when you write books, it opens up opportunities for conference ministry, and I've enjoyed doing that as well. It's always great to meet new Christian friends and to be able to minister God's Word in other contexts. This eventually led me to the situation where Zondervan invited me to join in on two of their debate books, the Counterpoint series. One was on eschatology, the other was on the book of Revelation. And those books have gone through about 15 or 20 different printings, and I'm really grateful for that opportunity through one of the nation's largest Christian publishers. And so I continue doing writing. In fact, I'm working on some writing projects now, and I'm really grateful for the education I got at Whitfield. It helped me hone my skills as well as opening up doors of opportunity for me.
Dr. Gentry, I know that you are both a student and colleague of Dr. Greg Bahnsen, the late Dr. Greg Bahnsen. Could you give us just some personal insight from your perspective of that godly man, what it was like being a student, a colleague, and I know you were a personal friend?
Yes, surely was. And I began studying under Dr. Bahnsen at Reformed Theological Seminary. In fact, he didn't even have his doctorate at that time. He was just completing it, got it about a year or so after I graduated. But I studied under him there. He was the best teacher I ever had, but he was also one of the more difficult teachers that I had. In fact, he was difficult because he required a lot of his students. He really had to put in the energy to get through his courses. And it paid off because I feel like he made a tremendous impact on my academic understanding as well as my ministerial capabilities. Then after entering into the pastorate upon graduating from Reformed Seminary, we conducted a conference at our church. It was the first conference that Little Church had, and Dr. Bahnsen was our first conference speaker. He was very well received there at Midway Presbyterian Church in Tennessee. And then we eventually became close friends. Not only was I now a student, but I was a co-laborer with him in ministry, so that we became friends. He visited often in my home when he was in the area. Of course, he was in California, and I've been out in Tennessee and South Carolina where he visited me. And we spoke together at various conferences, and we co-authored a book together, House Divided, The Breakup of Dispensational Theology. And so I also served with him at his invitation at the Southern California Center for Christian Studies, and also wrote for his Antithesis on several occasions. That was a journal he published while he was working with Southern California Center. And he called me, as a matter of fact, a day or two before his final surgery, and he alerted me to the fact he would appreciate my prayers, and because it was a very serious surgery, this valve implant surgery. And I could tell quickly in the conversation that this was really very serious. And as it turned out, he did die not long after the surgery, just a day or so after it. But he called to thank me for my friendship and ask for my prayers. And I'll never forget that conversation with him. And, of course, never forget his learning that he had passed away just a day or so later. So, yes, I had a good, strong relationship with Dr. Bahnsen, and I greatly miss him.
We'll return with Dr. Kenneth Gentry of Nicene Council Apologetics Group just after this break.
Whitfield Media Productions is proud to announce Dr. Gary Crampton's new book, Interpreting Edwards, an overview and analysis of John H. Gerstner's The Rational Biblical Theology of Jonathan Edwards. Here's what Dr. Kenneth Gary Talbot says about this publication. In this new work, Dr. Gary Crampton has once again turned our attention to the writings of Jonathan Edwards, interacting with Dr. John Gerstner's The Rational Biblical Theology of Jonathan Edwards, which is, according to Dr. Crampton, the most thorough study of the theology of Jonathan Edwards yet published. Dr. Crampton's evaluation of the writings of both Edwards and Gerstner delivers a wealth of knowledge that will allow the reader to benefit from the intellectual genius of America's finest theologian and philosopher. Interpreting Edwards, a publication of Whitfield Media Productions, a division of Whitfield Theological Seminary.
And we're back with Dr. Gentry. Doctor, I want to talk to you about your books and their content. In particular, let's talk just a little bit about, for example, Before Jerusalem Fell. Could you give us a little background and content as to the nature of that book?
Okay, that was my first really big book. I'd had a few smaller ones before that, but this book was over 400 pages. As a matter of fact, it's basically my doctoral dissertation that I wrote and submitted to Whitfield Theological Seminary. I had put so much work into it, and it was such an important issue, which I'll get to in a moment, that I decided to see if I could get it published. Dr. Gary North was very much interested in publishing it, and he did, and it sold well there, and it's been through several publishers since and been in print ever since about 1989, and I'm thankful for that. Before Jerusalem Fell is dealing with the dating of the book of Revelation, which is one of the more important introductory issues relative to that book. I make the argument in it from history, from theology, and from exegesis that John wrote Revelation prior to the destruction of the temple, which occurred in AD 70. In fact, I present an argument that he wrote somewhere around AD 65 and 66, which is just after the outbreak of the Neronic persecution in the year 64, and just before the formal engagement of the Jewish war with Rome in AD 67, which is why I put it in that time frame, because I see those two issues as relative to the book. And so in this book, I defend the notion that John did write this prior to AD 70, and therefore, in doing that, I'm swimming against the contemporary tide, which says he wrote it in the last years of Domitian in about AD 94 or 95. Now, the view that I'm presenting in that book and that I argued was originally the prevailing view in the 1800s and early 1900s, and then scholarly opinion shifted away from it. But with Before Jerusalem Fell, I started arguing that we ought to reconsider that date. And as a matter of fact, Before Jerusalem Fell has been widely quoted, such as in G.K. Beale's massive commentary on Revelation in the New International Greek Commentary and in various other important academic books. So I'm thankful that it's getting a hearing. I'm always thankful when I hear that it's influenced someone to change their view, and it's just been a really good opportunity, which once again helped me with be thankful for the work I did at Whitfield Theological Seminary.
Dr. Gentry, what do you think actually gave rise to the changing of the dating of the book of Revelation to come up with an older date after a couple of generations holding to the fact that it was completed before 70 AD?
Well, in the early church, one early church writer about AD 175 was Irenaeus, and he makes a statement in his book, Against Heresies, that seems to be asserting that John wrote Revelation in the last years of Domitian's reign. And with the church in the early 1900s beginning to shift to a view that's more open to tradition than open to exegesis, the tide was beginning to turn, and therefore the scholars of that day began to return to the idea that the traditional evidence is more compelling than the exegetical evidence within Revelation. In other words, what church fathers say about the book of Revelation held more sway than what Revelation says about itself, because of the theory of sources and redaction and all these various theologies that came to bear in the church and began to arise. Now, I do admit that Irenaeus' statement does appear to be very early. Well, it is very early, and it does appear to be very compelling, and it's by someone who is very knowledgeable in the church, so I can understand the significance of his statement. But the problem is, he's not as clear as we might wish that he was, and once we begin looking carefully at what he says, it doesn't say quite what many think that he says. But anyway, Before Jerusalem Fell does argue that point, and it's beginning to have a little bit of an influence in turning the tide. In fact, there have been a couple of books recently, commentaries, Stephen S. Smalley, in his commentary, which is a Greek text commentary on Revelation, and Ian Boxall, mm-hmm. in his commentary on Revelation. Both of these are within the past 5 years. They both argue for an early date. Now, they don't argue for an early date on the basis of my presentation, but they do argue it. So it helps me take some comfort in the fact that I'm not the only one out there calling for an early date of the book of Revelation, but we're seeing these Greek scholars beginning to turn back to this view that was held in the 17, 18, and early 1900s.
Tell us something about He Shall Have Dominion.
He Shall Have Dominion is my largest work to this date. It's about 600 pages. It is an attempt at providing a thorough argument for the eschatological view known as postmillennialism. That is, that Christ will return after the millennium. That is, that we are now in the millennium. The millennium is just John's symbolic statement of the kingdom of Christ. And postmillennialism teaches that Christ established his kingdom in the first century, and after he rules and begins to exercise greater and greater dominion, drawing more and more people into his kingdom, there will come a time in earth history in which Christianity will dominate the affairs of the world. And then Christ will return actually at the end of the millennium. He's reigning now from heaven. He will return at the end of the millennium, hence it is postmillennial. Now, He Shall Have Dominion makes a strong effort in presenting the postmillennial case from historical observations and from theological and from biblical exegetical argumentation. And I have even three chapters in there that are dealing with objections to postmillennialism. So I'm trying not only to present the case for postmillennialism, but to defend it against the most common objections to it. So it tends to be a very thorough, and probably is the largest book in defense of postmillennialism that's current in the market today.
And how does this view differ from what we would call historic and classical postmillennial thinking?
One issue that has changed in the modern argument for postmillennialism is that, for instance, in the Puritan postmillennialism, they held that the millennium of Revelation chapter 20 was still future to our time, and that the millennium would actually begin with the conversion of the Jews, and it's at that point in time and afterwards that the reign of Christ comes to full dominant expression in the affairs of man. So that they say that, yes, Christ will return after the millennium, but we're not in it yet. Whereas contemporary postmillennialists, such as me, Gary DeMar, Keith Matheson, and many others, associate that statement of John in Revelation 20 with the whole idea of the kingdom of Christ, which was established in the first century. So we say that John's statement in Revelation 20 is simply John's peculiar way of presenting the kingdom of Christ in his very peculiar book with the seven-headed beasts and things of that sort. So the major difference is, when is the millennium? The old line Puritan view is that the millennium begins with the conversion of the Jews in our future, and the current prevailing view says that no, the millennium begins when Christ establishes the kingdom in the first century. The Jews will ultimately be converted, but that's just a further progress of the kingdom, not the actual beginning of the millennium.
You've written a book called Navigating Through Revelation. What's that about, Dr. Gentry?
Well, I've been working for several years now on a massive commentary on the book of Revelation. It's probably going to be three volumes in length, or at least two very fat volumes. And in the meantime, I've gotten so many small excursies there, side studies that will be embedded in the larger commentary, that I thought it might be a good idea to kind of whet the appetite of those who are interested by publishing just a few of those excursies, those major studies within the book of Revelation. So Navigating the Book of Revelation gives some insights into some of my some of the angles I take in exegeting the book of Revelation, some of the new insights that I feel like I've discovered in it. And so I thought, well, there are people who have been supporting me in this venture. Maybe they'd like to see the fruit of their work in published form, and then also this would be a good promo for the fuller commentary. And so that's what Navigating the Book of Revelation is all about.
Let me stick within the context of eschatology. You wrote a book called Beast of Revelation.
Okay.
What was that book about?
Beast of Revelation grew out of my doctoral dissertation and the book Before Jerusalem Fell. Basically, the book, The Beast of Revelation, makes the argument that the beast, the seven-headed beast in the book of Revelation, is Rome, and that particularly the beast who has the number 666 is Nero Caesar. So that this ties the events of Revelation to the first century. If it's Nero Caesar and the Roman Empire that we're dealing with first century events. So the Beast of Revelation does make the argument that that beast, the first beast, the beast from the sea, is Nero Caesar.
Mm-hmm. And you have one called Perilous Times?
Yes, in Perilous Times, I engage in several eschatological questions. There are several texts that are, have been of great interest to the student of Scripture, as well as a great debate among scholars as to the meaning of the verses. And I deal with Daniel chapter 9, Daniel's 70 weeks. I deal with Matthew 24 in the Olivet Discourse, which involves the Great Tribulation and the Abomination of Desolation. Then I deal with 2 Thessalonians 2, Paul's man of sin. And then I deal with Revelation 13, which is the beast of Revelation, and Revelation chapter 17, which is the great harlot. So this book has just a few chapters covering in good substance, I believe, these big issues regarding Daniel's 70 weeks, the Olivet Discourse, the man of sin, the beast, and the harlot. So those are big eschatological issues, and I deal with those pretty carefully for a small work.
And you have one called The Divorce of Israel.
That's the one I'm actually working on now.
Okay.
And I will, I hope to be finishing that this year, and that's the title to my commentary on the book of Revelation, because of what I believe the theme of Revelation is about. So I'm still in the process of that one.
Okay. And then you just written one not too long ago released on predestination. Could you tell us a little bit what it's about and what was the motive for writing about predestination when we have so many books today out there on the subject itself?
Well, this is a part of a series that we're doing at NicenCouncil.com. Jerry Johnson, the president of NicenCouncil.com, got an idea that I thought was really a flash of genius when he said, let's do a series called Made Easy Series. And so what we're doing is summarizing in very clear format, but with good argumentation, some key issues that are being debated in the church. And of course, one of the issues that has divided Christians over the years is the doctrine of predestination. It is a very difficult doctrine. It's a very perplexing doctrine. It's one that really rankles people. And so we thought it might be good to put out a little 120 or 130 page summary of the argument for predestination. Now, of course, the classic work on this is by Lorraine Bettner, The Reformed Doctrine of Predestination, which is probably 400 or more pages long. But this, what we try to do is to get it down for the average Christian in the pew, giving enough information that he will see that it is biblical, and then answering objections so that he'll understand that the objections can be answered and that the doctrine of predestination is indeed biblical.
Excellent. Dr. Gentry, during your 28 years of ministry, how many churches now have you pastored?
I've pastored three or four. I began in Tennessee, in Jonesboro, Tennessee, Midway Presbyterian Church. I was there for 5 years. And then at Reedy River Presbyterian, I was there for 16 years, and those were in the PCA. And then I was for 4 years, I pastored in California in the church, as a matter of fact, that Dr. Bonson established and where he pastored until he died. And then I've moved back south again from California, and I currently am pastoring Living Hope Fellowship, where I've been for almost 2 years. And it's a church that is an affiliate with the Reformed Presbyterian Church General Assembly. We hope one day to be able to make a full and final commitment to be a full member of the RPCGA. But currently, our elders are grateful for the affiliate relationship with the RPCGA.
And how is that mission work going?
It's going really well. We started with about 20 folks. And we've got up to about, we've got 40 right now, as a matter of fact. We just had two join last Sunday and two the preceding Sunday. And so we're making slow but sure progress. I work there part-time. It's not like I'm able to give full-time effort to it. I would love to do that, but I work several jobs, as you noted at the beginning of this interview. And so, but the Lord is a blessing. We're very thankful for a good-hearted bunch of people who are eager to learn God's Word.
Could you tell us something about the various conferences that you've been holding, both here in the United States and, of course, internationally? I know you had some conferences in South Africa and Australia.
Okay.
How did those conferences go, and what happens at a Ken Gentry conference?
Well, the biggest conference I ever spoke at was the Ligonier Conference in 1999, where there were 4,000 attendees, and it was on eschatology. And because of my writing in the field of eschatology, most of the time when I'm invited out to speak, it's on doctrine of eschatology, although I do speak sometimes on creation, sometimes on God's law and some other issues. I'm not entirely locked into eschatology. It just seems to be what people have a great interest in, and therefore there's a market for it. Last year in September, October, I went to Australia for a conference. I was there about 19 days. Some of it was conference. A lot of it was looking around Australia and New Zealand, which we greatly enjoyed. I took my wife with me. That was a conference that was on the Book of Revelation. They were very eager to hear, and they very much enjoyed it and appreciated it. I got very good reviews back from folks and really have developed friendships with the folks down in Australia, and they say they'd like to have me back again sometime. Most of the conferences I've spoken at have been either in the South, Northeast, or on the West Coast, although I've got an opportunity that's just arisen, and I'll be going soon, probably committing to taking a conference in Kentucky pretty soon, and there's some more that are percolating, and I don't want to mention them before I'm committed to them because
right.
If it fell through or something, that would confuse. I do have another opportunity or two to speak in outside of the U.S., and I'm looking forward to that if those things work together, so I hope they will. I've spoken at a little more than 60 conferences in my 20 or 30 years of conference ministry.
Excellent. And how do you see people around the world, beyond the United States, how do you see people receiving the postmillennial dominion cultural mandate that you are teaching?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was at the American Vision Conference this past week, and I spoke with some gentleman from Bulgaria, and he mentioned, he came up to me and mentioned that my book, He Shall Have Dominion, had a tremendous impact on his Christian orientation. He was already a Christian, but he read that and says, you know, now there's hope. And he's been doing a really good work in Bulgaria, and I get emails, even letters, from people in various parts of the world. It's not like all 6.5 billion people in the world are writing to me, but there's a growing number of folks writing and expressing appreciation. And some of my books are being translated, for instance, into Portuguese and into Spanish, and are circulating in Brazil and in Mexico and other places. So I'm thankful for those opportunities, and I see the postmillennial hope arising on various continents among various types of Christians. In other words, not always just Reformed and Presbyterian. For instance, I've got a conference soon that I'll be going to that's the Southern Baptist Church. So I'm very thankful.
Excellent.
For the Lord opening these doors of opportunity, and thankful for the Spirit moving in such a way that a wider expanse of Christians are getting involved in the hope that is postmillennialism.
You've been involved in some debates also. What was the context and subject matter in those debates?
All right. Well, let me mention first off, I don't consider myself a debater. I'm a little too timid for that, but I have been involved in several debates. To me, debates take too long a time to get prepared for, and then I've noticed that very often people come in there with their views already settled, and so you don't really make much progress. So I'm not a real enthusiast for me debating. But some debates I've been in were a formal public debate with Dr. Thomas Ice in 2002. We were debating on the Olivet Discourse and whether Jesus is prophesying the destruction of the temple in the year 70, which I believe, or whether he's talking about the Great Tribulation off in the future, just before the Lord returns to the earth to establish the millennium, which Dr. Ice believed. We had a good discussion on it. And then I debated Dr. Richard Gaffin in 2003. Dr. Gaffin is an amillennial scholar and a very gracious gentleman. I enjoyed meeting him and getting to know him. In fact, I've spoken at a conference since then where we spoke together on eschatology rather than debating one another. And so that was an interesting conference. And then the last really formal public debate I had was with Dr. Robert Rayburn in 2004 regarding the question of paedal communion. Now, I've had a lot of radio interview debates where I'm with some other person on the other end of the line. It's not formal. It's, you know, how radio debates can go. It's a little over-talking each other sometimes. But on issues such as tongue speaking and alcohol and eschatology and God's law and some other issues like that. But for formal public structured debates, really I've only had three, but have had a lot of debates that were less structured and yet considered debates.
Our guest is Dr. Kenneth Gentry of Nicene Council Apologetics Group, and we'll continue our show after this break.
Parents, are you looking for a college to send your children to in the near future? Hi, I'm Dr. Randall Talbot, the Executive Vice President and Academic Dean of Whitfield College. Let me share with you why I think you should consider Whitfield College. First, Whitfield brings a Christian college education home to you. We are a distant learning online institution. Second, Whitfield provides a biblical worldview college education. Third, affordability. Because we are a distance learning institution, we can provide a high academic education that you can afford. The average tuition for most online colleges is $300 or more per credit hour. At Whitfield, we charge $80 per credit hour. Fourth, graduates from Whitfield College are highly educated in the majors that we provide. We have graduates that have entered graduate schools all across the country in various different fields. Institutions like the University of Massachusetts of North Dartmouth, Liberty University Law School, and various seminaries. If you would like further information, you may visit the Whitfield College website at whitfieldcollege.org, or you may call the college offices at 863-683-7899. I am looking forward to hearing from you.
Our guest is Dr. Kenneth Gentry, noted theological scholar in eschatological doctrine. Dr. Gentry, one of the things I would like to ask you, just kind of a little off point, what's your opinion concerning the state of the church as it relates to the cultural mandate in this generation?
Well, it seems to me that the church, and I have to obviously speak from within the context of the American sphere of the evangelical church, but it seems to me that our brothers in the church here in America, in the evangelical world, have really dropped the ball in terms of worldview orientation. Too many are interested in church growth at all costs. They don't want to offend anybody or step on toes. They want to get the numbers in. They want to constantly preach the gospel, which obviously is very important, but there's more to Christianity than simply how to be saved. Dr. Gary North lamented a few years ago that the Presbyterian Church no longer preaches doctrine because the Baptist Church across the street has a bigger gymnasium. And his point was that people are looking for the social camaraderie that's associated with the church rather than going to church as first to worship God and second to learn of Him and to equip them for service in the kingdom. I am receiving, you know, vibes, I guess you could say, that the church, that many within the evangelical church are beginning to reconsider the worldview orientation that they've left behind because of some of these letters and conference engagements and things of that sort. And so I'm hopeful that the church, especially in these trying times with a bad economy and bad federal administration and other issues, I'm hoping that Christians will see that we really need to stand up and be counted. We need to understand what Christianity is all about in terms of the big picture. So I'm really hopeful that the Lord will pour out His Spirit on us and begin to awaken evangelical, Bible-believing Christians to their great calling.
Amen.
Now, Jesus gave what we call the Great Commission, and certainly it is great. It's great in many respects. In the first place, He introduces the Great Commission in Matthew 28, verse 18, by saying He has all authority in heaven and on earth. Now, that's pretty great. And then He says, go make disciples of all the nations. That's a pretty great outlook, that the nations are to be brought to Christ, all of them. And then He says, teach all things whatsoever I've taught you. And that's a pretty big project there, which is great, because we're to teach all the things that Christ taught us, not just a few, not just how to evangelize, but everything He taught us.
Mm-hmm.
And then He ends up by saying, I'll be with you all the days. Literally, in the Greek, it says all the days. And that's a great deal of time He's given us. So He's given us, on the basis of all authority, the commission to go make disciples of all the nations, training them in all things He taught us. And He says He'll be with us all the days until the very end. So that Great Commission has a lot of potency in it. And as the church awakens to it and shakes herself and arises with renewed strength, I think we'll begin to see better progress than we have in just the last few years.
Amen. As I noted earlier, you are director of NicenCouncil.com and TheApologeticsGroup.com. Dr. Gentry, what are these ministries and what is your role in them?
NicenCouncil.com engages in Christian worldview activities. They are probably best known for the production of DVDs, informational documentary types of DVDs. One of their best-selling items is Amazing Grace, which deals with the doctrines of grace, and it's a bestseller, in fact, and has ministered to a lot of people. And Jerry Johnson is now about to release a new DVD called Beware of False Prophets, where he's warning the church about the heresies associated with the name of, I forgot his name, you're going to have to bleep this out.
Charles Finney.
Oh, okay. Jerry Johnson is working on a DVD right now, and it's about to be produced and released. It's called Beware of False Prophets, that's dealing with the heresies associated with Charles G. Finney. Finney is one of the modern, mid to late 1800s, one of the modern exponents of the evangelistic revivalism that we experience today. And so many evangelicals look to him as, you know, a figure to be adored in the Church of Jesus Christ. But Jerry Johnson has pointed out a number of heresies that this man promoted. Well, anyway, so at Nicene Council's involved in Christian worldview activities. Basically, I've come on to work with Jerry, and I'm overseeing their book publishing, which is more or less a new aspect of the Full Orbs ministry of Nicene Council. I'm overseeing book publishing. I'm writing most of the books. I'm editing some of those, and I get things organized for the printer, and so we're really starting to see the book publishing end of it pick up some. Now, I do work with Jerry on co-writing documentaries. Generally, it's the case that he gets the concept, he provides the basic structure, then I go through and add some things and make some recommendations, and kind of we work together, tag team duo there, trying to get a good documentary out. So our next documentary that we're going to be working on very soon is The Late Great Planet Church, Volume 2. Volume 1 was a bestseller. It sold a great number of copies, and we've had a lot of people wanting Volume 2, and we'll be doing that getting it finally organized within the next month or so, and then hope to have it out not too much past the first of the year.
Dr. Gentry, I also understand that the Nicene Council will also begin putting together the Volume 2 of Amazing Grace, dealing with the fundamentals of the Reformed faith, which will cover the five solas of the Reformation. How soon do you think we will be able to see that come into its existence?
Well, I'm not entirely sure, partly for two reasons. One is I mostly focus on the book publishing end, but secondly, I know that we've got to get Late Great Planet Church out, and Jerry, in fact, yesterday sent me the manuscript for The Late Great Planet Church, Volume 2, and I'm to begin working on that and massaging it and seeing what we can do to perfect that. Then we're going to have to go into production on that, which means having fly in some people and interview them and record all that. So my guess is it might be a little after The Late Great Planet Church. Now, I haven't really gotten a production schedule on that, so I'm not real sure because, again, I'm in the book publishing end mostly.
Yes. We're going to take a break, and we'll return with Dr. Kenneth Gentry.
Are you looking for a denomination that continues in the heritage of the historic Confessing Church? The Reformed Presbyterian Church General Assembly maintains the Westminster Confession of Faith of 1647, together with the larger and shorter catechisms as our subordinate standards. We further recognize the value of other Reformed creedal standards and their acceptable use among our churches in teaching the theology of the Reformation. We're also unique as a denomination in that we embrace the doctrine of biblical inerrancy, maintain a literal 24-hour, six consecutive day creationist view of Genesis, reject the modern-day Erastian teaching of church incorporation, practice male head of household voting, encourage family-integrated church practices, require an educated eldership, adhere to a two-office view of the church, Southern Presbyterian, while maintaining a threefold function of the eldership, preaching, teaching, and governing, and promote and support the training of our children in Christian educational institutions, especially in the homeschooling method. Come and visit the RPCGA website at rpcga.com or rpcga.us and review the standards, the Book of Church Order, and other position papers. A listing of churches and ministers is also available. Our website, again, is located at rpcga.com or rpcga.us. Consider becoming a part of the historic Confessing Church, teaching and maintaining the Westminster Standards.
We're back with our guest, Dr. Kenneth Gentry. Dr. Gentry, you're involved and Good Birth Ministries. Could you tell us about that work and your involvement?
Good Birth Ministries is a non-profit research and Christian education ministry. It was basically established in order to provide me funding so that I could spend a good deal of time on my Revelation commentary research. For two entire years, it was my sole funding. and I was able to get a lot of work done on my commentary. It is still in operation and is still funding me, this time on a part-time basis, since I also work with Nicene Council and with Living Hope Fellowship. But I use Good Birth Ministries as a source of funding to help in my Revelation research. Now, Good Birth Ministries has some other ideas out in the future that we want to get involved in, and one of those is involving a Greek text project that I hope to be able to get started on maybe in about 12 months from now. I'm not real sure, because we do have to get out the commentary first. But I'm thankful for all those who are able to give to that. It does help me free up time so that I can work on these projects that I consider quite important, and they're certainly big projects. And if anyone would like to join in and help, you can do so by looking on my website, kennethgentry.com, or the Good Birth Ministries website, and see how you might be able to help there.
Doctor, you mentioned that you are currently writing a commentary on the book of Revelation. I know that this has been an ongoing project for a long time now. Could you tell us just a little bit about the thematic structure and content as you understand Revelation, so that our listeners might better grasp what it is you're trying to accomplish?
Okay, my approach to the book of Revelation is very much different from what you hear in the major media of the evangelical world. I differ very much from the late great Planet Earth. I differ very much from the Left Behind series and all the many thousands of books that have been published in that field of endeavor. And some of the basics that will give the listener some insight into my approach to the book of Revelation is, whenever I talk to someone about the book of Revelation, I say, if you will read the first three verses and think about those first three verses, you will find that the book of Revelation is something quite different than what you have thought it is. And the first three verses really summarize the whole approach to the book of Revelation. Verse 1 says, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his bondservants the things which must shortly take place. John is talking about something that he said was shortly to take place. Mm-hmm. In verse 3, he says, blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of the prophecy and heed those things which are written in it. For, in other words, this is why, for the time is near. And so according to John, the things are shortly to take place because the time is near. He says the same thing in Revelation 22, verses 6 and 10. In other words, as he introduces the book and as he closes it, he says these things are shortly to come to pass. That will not allow us to put the book of Revelation off 2,000 years distant from John's day. It will not allow us to put the main thrust of the book of Revelation off in the future from our day. John says these things were to be soon. So my approach to Revelation is to dealing with issues that were soon in John's day. Now, I think what he's dealing with in Revelation is the judgment of God upon Israel for rejecting the Messiah. In Revelation 1:7, it says that really is the theme of the whole book, and it says, behold, he is coming with the clouds, and every eye will see him, even those who pierced him, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn over him. Even so, amen. That language there, behold, he is coming with the clouds, is Old Testament language, talking about divine historical judgments, as in Isaiah 19:1, when it says God will come upon the clouds and ride into Egypt and knock over their idols. Isaiah 19:1 is talking about a historical judgment in history, a judgment in history by God against men on the earth. Well, I think Revelation 1:7 is talking about a judgment in history, and I think that judgment is what he says, it's against those who pierced him. And if you read Acts, you'll see that the Jews were constantly blamed for killing Christ, and it's against all the tribes of, literally, the land. So he's coming to judge those who pierced him, the Jews, and all the tribes of the land, that is the land of Israel, will mourn because of him. So my understanding of the book of Revelation is that it is dealing with God's judgment through Christ upon Israel, first century Israel, for rejecting the Messiah, He's going to be destroying your temple, removing it from history, and by that action, he is formally, finally, and completely disestablishing the old covenant economy. Now, it was legally disestablished at the cross when Christ died and the temple veil was rent in two, but, of course, as we read Acts, we find that Paul and other disciples and apostles went into the temple and engaged, in some respects, in temple worship. So by the year 70, we have a final, complete cessation of the Old Covenant so that no one can go to a temple anymore and offer up Old Covenant-type worship to God. So AD 70 is the conclusion of the Old Covenant economy and the final episode beginning the New Covenant economy. And so in the book of Revelation, it's interesting that it focuses on the Old Testament more than any other book in the New Testament. It alludes to more passages than any other book. It is filled with Jewish imagery, and its grammar, its syntax, its language is more Hebraic than any book in the New Testament. In fact, some major commentators such as R.H. Charles and David E. Ahn have had to develop a Greek grammar to go along with the book of Revelation because it is so Hebraic. And that fits perfectly with what I believe the book is doing. It's dealing with God's judgment upon Israel. John is taking upon himself the Old Testament prophet mantle. He's picked up the mantle of the Old Testament prophet, and he's challenging Israel, just like John the Baptist did in Matthew 3 and Mark 1 and other texts. And what I believe is going on there, if you follow the flow of Revelation, the main drift of it begins in chapter 4, where John is caught up in the heaven and he sees God on the throne. God is there on his judicial throne.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter 5, he has a seven-sealed scroll that Jesus takes from his hand and begins opening. Well, I believe that's God's divorce decree against Israel. And then in chapter 6 through 19, with some interruptions and corollary studies, he's dealing with the capital punishment of the great harlot, which is Israel. It's Jerusalem. He's dealing with the capital punishment of Jerusalem, who is presented in the book as a great harlot. And then once God disposes of his Old Testament wife, who has become a harlot, in chapters 20 through 22, we see the coming of the new creation and a new bride, which is the church. So I've titled my commentary, The Divorce of Israel. It is dealing with God's putting aside Israel in divorce because she has not been faithful to him as a wife should be, and his taking of a new wife, the Church of Jesus Christ.
Dr. Gentry, in your system, we know that you use the term preterism, and as it relates to 70 AD, could you be a little more specific about what is preterism so our people understand?
All right. Preterism is a view that preterism, the word itself, is based on a Latin word, preteritus, which means passed by. So the preterist viewpoint is the opposite of the futurist viewpoint. The futurist tells us that the events of the book of Revelation are off in our future. The preterist approach says, no, they're not off in our future, they're in our past. And preterism is an exegetical tool for understanding certain passages in the New Testament that speak of near-term events. Now, there are those who try to expand the preterist principle in areas where Scripture is not even speaking of such issues, but as a matter of fact, there are many texts in the New Testament that tell us that these things shall happen while in this generation, shortly come to pass, the time is near, some of you standing here shall not taste of death until. Those kind of references deal with enormous issues that are about to break forth in the first century experience of God's people. And they are in our past, and therefore they're to be understood preteristically. Unfortunately, dispensationalism today tends to take those passages, despite those near-term qualifications, and project them off into our future. The whole Left Behind series is based upon misappropriating scriptures from Jesus in Matthew 24 and John in Revelation, the whole book of Revelation. And so, preterism is an exegetical tool. It's not a theology. Those who take it as a theology are developing an alien theological approach to Scripture. They're reinterpreting all of Scripture. True preterism, as historically understood, is an exegetical tool for understanding certain select passages that speak of near-term events. And it is constrained, the good Orthodox preterism is constrained by the text itself, rather than letting our imaginations run riot and then impose a preterist principle upon all of the New Testament.
Would it not be correct to say in eschatological thought that the evangelical Orthodox nature of what defines an acceptable millennial perspective, especially concerning end times, what you would find are at least four essential doctrines: the second coming, or what they call the second appearance of Christ, or a reappearance of Christ at the consummation of history, history itself being one aspect of that, that it comes to an end, that there is a resurrection both of the living and the dead, the transformation of the body, and then a final judgment. Are those not the essence of what still qualifies as a proper evangelical Orthodox system of eschatology that is acceptable within Christianity?
Yes, I believe that those are four fundamentals of creedal orthodoxy that have defined the eschatology of the Orthodox Church of Jesus Christ throughout history. And once you breach even one of those points, you're getting out into heterodoxy, and there are some of those who are making shipwreck of the Scriptures themselves by the preterist principle even into these areas and saying the second coming of Christ has already happened, the great judgment has already happened, that all of these events have occurred in the first century, and that we're on the earth and we'll be here forever and ever and ever and ever, and history will never end, sin will never be completely and finally dealt with by God, and this is all there is. And now that's known as hyperpreterism, and it's an altogether different and alien theology.
It is, by our standards, a heretical teaching.
Well, yes, and it depends on who you mean by our standards. It's the standard of the historic Christian church, not just you and me, and not just Reformed Christians, but the standards of the historic Christian church that are at risk here with the hyperpreterist movement.
We're going to take a break, and we will return with our guest, Dr. Kenneth Gentry.
Whitfield Media Productions is proud to announce Dr. Gary Crampton's new book, Interpreting Edwards, an overview and analysis of John H. Gerstner's The Rational Biblical Theology of Jonathan Edwards. Here's what Dr. Kenneth Gary Talbot says about this publication. In this new work, Dr. Gary Crampton has once again turned our attention to the writings of Jonathan Edwards, interacting with Dr. John Gerstner's The Rational Biblical Theology of Jonathan Edwards, which is, according to Dr. Crampton, the most thorough study of the theology of Jonathan Edwards yet published. Dr. Crampton's evaluation of the writings of both Edwards and Gerstner delivers a wealth of knowledge that will allow the reader to benefit from the intellectual genius of America's finest theologian and philosopher. Interpreting Edwards, a publication of Whitfield Media Productions, a division of Whitfield Theological Seminary.
We're back with Dr. Kenneth Gentry, author, lecturer, professor, pastor, and theological scholar. I want to ask you, Doctor, where can our listeners get your books and DVDs?
Well, you can get everything I've produced at my KennethGentry.com website. I carry even things that nobody wants that I've written on my website. So if you're into all things Kenneth Gentry has written or spoken, then that's where you find them. Now, most of the more popular or better selling items can be found also at NicenCouncil.com. And of course, you can find a number of other things there at NicenCouncil.com as well. My website, KennethGentry.com, only handles my own products, and Nicene Council handles mine and other people's as well.
If someone was just starting to study eschatology, the doctrine of last things or end times, what would you recommend they begin reading first, and maybe a few books thereafter?
Well, I wrote He Shall Have Dominion for this express purpose to clearly and powerfully present the whole case for postmillennialism. It's very thorough, very comprehensive, but it is also 600 plus pages. If someone doesn't really have the time to be able to engage the issue that thoroughly, I would highly recommend they're considering the introduction, which is called Postmillennialism Made Easy. I wrote this for that very purpose. It's more or less of a tract, as it were, a 120 or 30 page tract for postmillennialism. It goes over the main issues, and probably that would be the best way for someone to whet their appetite and get their orientation, and then later maybe get into He Shall Have Dominion. But then again, I could also highly recommend Keith Matheson's book, Postmillennialism, mm-hmm. Gary DeMar's book, Last Day's Madness. These are helpful key components of the modern eschatological debate from our perspective.
And it's our hope in the future we'll be able to launch a show just on eschatology with Dr. Gentry called Last Day Madness, with various guests coming on and discussing eschatological issues. Dr. Gentry, I want to thank you for appearing on True Believer, and we look forward to having you back on our program in the near future.
Well, Dr. Talbot, I appreciate the opportunity, and I wish you well in this ministry. I trust that it goes well for you.
Thank you, brother. I want to thank our audience for listening to True Believer. Please let others know about this current podcast and past podcasts that are archived on our website. If possible, please either register as a member on the Whitfield Radio site or become a fan of Whitfield Radio on Facebook. Until our next show, may God bless and keep you in His love.
You've been listening to Whitfield Radio. Whitfield Radio is a division of Whitfield College and Theological Seminary. Music is provided by our friend, Dr. Phil Kagi, and we encourage you to visit his website at philkagi.com, philkagi.com. This is Dr. Bill Sullivan saying thank you for joining us, and check out our website for the next scheduled show. Have a blessed day.